Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
In our show today, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Amy Fowler from the Department of Ophthalmology at the University of North Carolina about eyelid surgery, which actually occurs to a lot more people than we commonly think.
It's true. My mom had to have eyelid surgery not too long ago and actually researched Dr. Fowler because I was going to refer my mom to her. So I'm glad we get to finally talk with her today.
Well, my mom might have had to have it too. I can't disclose that because my mom would probably hurt me.
Yeah,
but
well,
she was in a different state. And this is a common issue, and we look forward to talking with Dr. Fowler.
Okay. Well, first we have some research that matters, Adam. We're going to talk about kids swallowing batteries.
And this is not a good thing.
No, about a different way of doing a colonoscopy.
A laxative-free way, and about a health coaching. Now, this isn't the type of coaching that basketball, but coaching for lowering your blood pressure.
And also about using steroids in the nose to manage sinusitis.
Sounds like that could be painful, but it might be good too.
I know. We'll talk
about
it.
Maybe it decreases pain. We'll find out. Let's talk about this very first research about – what's this about swallowing batteries, Christy? Come on now. Let's fess up.
Well, apparently this – I mean, this is pretty common that swallowing batteries and visits to the emergency department as a result of kids swallowing batteries has almost doubled over the past 20 years. Still not, you know, super common every single day, but more of these tiny little buttons, like button batteries.
So we're not talking about those AAA batteries or the AA batteries. The kids aren't getting their hands on those little oblong batteries, but they're those little new ones that are in remote control devices and watches.
And little toys now.
Where do they find them?
Well, they're in a lot of toys, and a lot of times they're
those
not
talking
secured
toys.
Very well. And so,
right.
You know, they either
little
fall
plastic
out
screws.
Or you can, yeah.
And then these kids swallow them. They get lodged in the esophagus, in and of itself a really bad problem. But then also these batteries, and so they can have electrical current and perhaps cause some erosion of the esophagus. That could be life-threatening.
You can have a little leak of acid and erode, make a little hole, kind of burn a little hole. So that can be dangerous.
Yeah, and they found in this study from the journal Pediatrics that with 100 hospitals between 1990 and 2009, 20 years, 65,000 kids had a battery-related emergency room visit. I went, what?
Yeah.
That I just couldn't believe. I mean, this is enough to make you just caution in our conversations with parents to make this one of the things we have to talk about.
Well, I mean, it's just another thing that we have to pay attention to with safety of our toddlers. These little shiny things are just the kind of thing you'd want to put in your ear or put in your mouth and to check toys and check your remotes and make sure those
even
things are
hearing
secure.
Aids, yeah. If you're living with grandparents or mm-hmm. others who might have hearing aids there. So something that we should all be aware of, and hopefully we can do a much better job of preventing. What's our next research that matters?
Okay, this is about colonoscopy. So I don't know about you, Adam, but a lot of my patients don't want to get their colonoscopy because they don't want to drink all that stuff that is a laxative.
Oh, I look forward to that, Christy. You know, it was one of the highlights in the recent past when I had that. You're no longer constipated. Let's be face it, it's not the highlight of anyone's day to have to take that 2-gallon prep.
No, but we do know that colonoscopies are very, very important for preventing colon cancer. So this was a study looking, this was done at Brigham and Women's Hospital and a variety of health centers, looking at a different way of doing a CT scan-based form of colonoscopy doesn't require you to drink so much laxative.
Yeah, this was in the Annals of Internal Medicine. And they did they were put on a low-fiber diet, and then they had to drink an agent that could show up when they did the CAT scan in the colon, this contrast agent, and then they could compare to what extent they could diagnose those precancerous polyps as well as the colonoscopy. Because if it doesn't work as well, no one's going to recommend it.
And when we did a second pass colonoscopy to then confirm or remove any missed polyps if they were missed on this new type of testing, And they found that the laxative-free CT method was pretty comparable to the standard colonoscopy, catching more than 90% of the larger adenomas, but it didn't do as well to identify the smaller polyps.
Yeah, and I also worried even about that you are getting radiation in this procedure, though I do know they said it was lower for this type of procedure than a typical CAT scan. It is more than you would get with a colonoscopy, which is not any radiation.
Not at all.
So I do think that this is a worrisome feature, and I don't think this is ready for prime time yet.
I don't either. I think really the take-home message, if you're a listener out there, get your colon cancer screening. If you're not willing to do a colonoscopy, there are other ways to do it. They're not as good, and we're starting to research new methods. But do get some type of colon cancer screening.
And we'll wait to hear a little bit more about this before we probably recommend it. But let's talk about something we actually do recommend, I think, more and more, particularly in what's called our PCMH, our patient-centered medical home. This team approach to treating high blood pressure. What's this next research that matters, Christy?
So we know that it's really common for people to have high blood pressure and for people to have poor blood pressure control, meaning high blood pressure that's not at a good range. That puts people at higher risk for heart attacks and strokes. And I think a lot of times people don't either understand the significance or feel like, well, I don't feel bad, so why should I take all these medicines? So this is looking at health coaching and to see if that makes a difference, having someone to counsel and coach you through it, either with home changes of medicines of blood pressure versus just health coaching without going into the home to change your blood pressure medicines.
Right. This was research in the Annals of Family Medicine, and they took two groups of patients, about 120 each, and they either got this home blood pressure monitoring and this weekly health coaching, and then to change their blood pressure at home based upon the results, half got that, half did not. And they found at the end of 6 months that the two groups weren't different when comparing to each other, but compared to where they started, both groups had significant differences and improvements.
I mean, almost 22 points of the systolic or the top number of your blood pressure was improved in both groups. And they also had a decrease in the number of primary care visits as well as other benefits. And the thing that I was struck with is that there was a dose response of the coaching encounter. So the more health coaching encounters a patient had, the greater their reduction in blood pressure. And that to me suggests that, you know, people just need someone that they trust to talk them through it and spend more time helping them understand blood pressure medications, how to treat blood pressure, what does it mean?
Well, this population approach to treating disease. Christy, this weekend I had a patient with very high blood sugar levels, and I could have just sent them to the emergency room, but I decided, you know what, I could probably talk with them four or five times over the phone, a very good family, good social support, and we worked our way through in terms of taking insulin and actually had to call it in, and they had to start it, and teaching them, and a lot of things you would think would be difficult, but actually it wasn't that difficult. And the phone conversations, four phone calls, took about 10 minutes. Now, our current healthcare system doesn't necessarily reward that sort of work, but in the future, it's critical, and I bet it will.
Absolutely. Let's talk about our last research that matters, and this is about giving steroids in the nose, like these steroid sprays for acute sinusitis.
And Christy and I have talked about the treatment of acute sinusitis, and increasingly it is not something that we routinely give antibiotics for initially, but this research also in the Annals of Family Medicine was what's called the systematic review or the meta-analysis, bringing together the different trials. And in this case, there were six studies involving about 2,500 patients looking at the effects of this intranasal or these sprays of steroids in the nose, and does it improve outcomes of sinus infections?
And what they found are that the people who received these nasal steroids had significant but small increases in resolution or improvement of their symptoms if they did it for days 14 through 21. So you really had to do it every day for a period of time to get the benefit. The main benefit was in facial pain and congestion, but it did have a small benefit. So for certain patients who are willing to take this, it may show promise. And it's certainly not a wrong thing to do, whereas we're developing lots of studies showing antibiotics show no benefit.
Well, Christy, we've had a good chance to talk about this belief that health coaching certainly is something that we recommend in helping to improve all kinds of disease outcomes, including high blood pressure.
different way of doing a colonoscopy. Bottom line is get some sort of colon cancer screening if you're over the age of 50.
If you see these little button batteries anywhere, get them out of the way of children.
And finally, about nasal steroids in the management of sinusitis, that it may have some small benefit.
That'll conclude Research That Matters. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Amy Fowler about eyelid surgery. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Adam and I get to talk with Assistant Professor of Ophthalmology and the Residency Program Director at UNC for Ophthalmology, Dr. Amy Fowler, about eyelid surgery, a new topic. We haven't talked very much about the eyes on the show, have we, Adam?
Well, I think we had a show about cataracts, but the reality is the number of patients, Christy, that you and I have with eyelid problems is really quite large. It seems like everyone has probably maybe gone and seen Dr. Fowler. Welcome to the show, Dr. Fowler.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
And I think, you know, I think just let's dive right into this topic, which is, you know, I imagine a lot of people go to medical school and residency and then they go into ophthalmology. But to specialize in really surgery of the eyelids themselves, what got you interested in this particular area?
That's a good question. You know, whatever strikes us as being something we're interested in is never quite known. But when I did my ophthalmology residency at Duke, I just loved the ophthalmic plastic surgery portion. Cataract surgery is wonderful. People see great afterwards. They're getting their vision restored, and that can be a real rush. But just the mechanics of the surgery, the types of surgery, the creativity behind, you know, how we approach different problems for eyelid surgery, just appealed
to me. Well, I think
people
take it for granted that the eyes open naturally.
Correct.
And how important the eyes are to the whole facial structure. I know my relatives, or a lot of them, are dentists, and they talk about how the teeth are so important to the what your smile to,
right,
your sense of well-being. I don't know if that's the same thing with the eyes.
Well, it's interesting talking about dentistry as well. They've done some studies, and when people look at a person's face, the two most common places the eyes track to are the eyes and the mouth. And so those are the two things that we look at the most as we're looking at someone. Eyes have a lot of expression. Eyebrows, where they're positioned, can tell you if you're angry, sad, happy, express a lot of emotion through the eyebrows and how the eyes look.
As you're saying that, I'm raising my eyebrows.
Right.
Yes.
Could you know?
but it's also a really fine space. And usually the eyelids are relatively, particularly as a person gets older, very thin space that can have a dramatic difference,
right,
in how you look.
So eyelid skin is the thinnest skin of the body. And just like any other part of the body, they're prone to diseases, skin cancers, you know, and so that's part of what I do. Certainly, you know, we talk about the importance of the eyelids, and you don't think about the eyelid skin as compared to other parts of the body, the skin on the other parts of the body. We have to be able to open our eyes, close our eyes. There has to be function. So anytime we're reconstructing an eyelid or planning eyelid surgery, we have to really consider the functionality of the eyelids before we consider even the cosmesis of how things are going to look surgically. So if we can't protect our eyeballs, we're not going to be able to see. And that's the most important part, is protecting the eye.
Well, this really hit home recently, where my mom had a cyst that grew on her eyelid. And it was just a little cyst at first. She's not real wrapped into you know, she's a beautiful woman, but not wrapped into like plastic surgery.
Like
kind
mother,
of stuff.
Like daughter. Just,
good daughter, man. Wow.
Anyway, she's not wrapped into plastic surgery or anything, but the cyst kind of grew and she had to have it removed and then it grew back and she had to have it removed. And I mean, just the fineness and the technique that and the skill that was required of a surgeon to go in there and remove this tiny little thing and these tiny little layers. I mean, I was just so impressed as a doctor. I can do stitch people up and
right.
do that on the skin, but this is really requires
We put the needle right through the eye, though.
Yeah, exactly. Not in somebody's eye.
The eye of the needle is not...
oh, my
but
gosh.
But you must have to use a microscope. I mean, you must have to really use magnifying techniques and other things to... It's fine, fine detail, huh?
So ophthalmology itself is microsurgery. I'm not quite... to that level, but we use loops all the time. So I have my magnifier loops. I have three different pairs. I keep a pair everywhere I practice, and I have a little specific light source that I use to help me see so I can see and have good magnification right there. But cysts of the eyelids, very common. There's different things that cause cysts of the eyelids, but if they're incompletely excised, cysts tend to close and fill back up with whatever they were filled up with in the first place. So
in that story, the surgeon or the doctor must not have gotten all of the cysts
right.
out the first time.
And I don't know if she saw an oculoplastics person like myself or not, but certainly having better familiarity with the, you know, eyelid anatomy and the outcomes of surgical procedures of the eyelids, I'm probably a lot more bold and make sure that I get the, you know, those types
get
of lesions out completely. That's right.
Because it's a lot of trouble to have to keep going through
it
the
is.
Surgery and the anxiety of it all.
You know, and then you've got swollen eyelid and a black and blue eye from having anesthetic injected and all of that. So you really want to minimize how many times you go through something like that. And plus, it's nerve-wracking to have somebody working on your eyelid, you know, with sharp objects, sharp instruments, that type of thing. So,
well, let's actually kind of dive into the eye a little bit. Help us understand some of the common conditions we've mentioned, and Christy was just talking about a cyst on the eye. What are some of the most common things that you deal with? Because I think this eye problems is actually more common than we think.
That's correct. What I deal with the most, the very most common condition would be what we call dermatocholasis, which is extra
Wait
upper...
Wait a second. Better say that again.
Dermatocholasis, which is extra upper eyelid skin. When the eyelid skin becomes redundant and heavy due to birthdays, gravity, environment,
so
genetics.
So the skin on your eyes kind of droops down over your eye?
Correct. In combination with that, ptosis, which is spelled with a silent P, P-T-O-S-I-S, and that's when the eyelid edge itself droops down. So people can have heavy upper eyelids because of one, the other, or both together. And what people don't often recognize is how this comes on very slowly, so it's affecting their peripheral vision very slowly, so they don't realize they're having peripheral vision problems to begin with. And then they also don't realize that for most insurance companies and Medicare, the upper eyelids will affect vision if they get too droopy and they start to hang into your pupils. So
it's not just a cosmetic kind of thing.
Upper eyelid surgery, blepharoplasty is the surgery to remove the extra upper eyelid skin. Ptosis repair is the surgery to lift the edge of the eyelid margin. And a large percentage of my patients are covered by insurance to have those two surgeries done. So that's probably the most.
So much that they can't even see.
And sometimes it's not even that dramatic. I mean, I certainly have people where their lids have drooped beyond their pupil and they're constantly raising their forehead muscles, using their forehead muscles to try to lift their eyelids and see better. But then there are others that it droops to just within the pupil or very close. And again, cataract surgery, man, I get that vision back and it's a real kick, but it surprises me how excited people get when they come back and say, hey, I can change lanes in my car now because I didn't realize that peripheral vision had been so restricted before.
And they probably also cosmetically feel better.
That's correct.
In other ways. Let me ask a question, though, and this is maybe my own bias even, you know, as a physician, but is this occur more commonly in women than men, or is it the same? And are men less likely to get treatment or not? I really don't know.
I think men are less likely to get treatment. I remember one of my first male patients. He was really nervous about having a blepharoplasty done, and he had a breakfast group that he met with, you know, I think it was like five or six other guys. He finally decided to have his surgery, and he decided to go to his Saturday breakfast group, although he was puffy and bruised and had stitches. He found out that he was the last one of the group to get the surgery. They had never really talked about it, but he was all embarrassed that it was a strike against his masculinity, and here he was the last one of the group to actually get it done.
They talk about the Viagra together, but they wouldn't talk about the
blood. Their droopy lids. So really, you know, the incidence pretty equal. You know, everybody, male versus female, are going to be subject to the same environment, sun damage, genetics, gravity, all of that. But I think you're right. I do see more female patients than males, but probably by 2 to 1. But it's equal incidence.
We do need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Amy Fowler, about eyelid surgery. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We have been talking with Dr. Amy Fowler, Assistant Professor of Ophthalmology and the Residency Program Director at UNC for Ophthalmology, about eyelid surgery. And Dr. Fowler, you were talking before about cysts and talking a little bit about problems with eyelid droopiness and people that being a little more common to get it fixed than others. What are the other common things that you take care of in the office?
So the next probably two common things I would say, one is actually lower eyelid surgery, not puffy eyelids. That's blepharoplasty, and while I do that type of surgery, that's cosmetic. But there's a lot of lower eyelid stretchiness or droop that can contribute to dryness or dry eye. The other thing that's very common overall, but probably very common in North Carolina in particular, are skin cancers of the eyelids. So as we were saying earlier, eyelid skin is not immune to all of the damage that the rest of our body gets to subject to as well.
So what do we know about a skin cancer of the eyelids? I mean, I know that we know that certain forms of like melanoma might be related to, you know, intense sunburns and, mm-hmm. and squamous cell and basal cell cancers. What do we know about those types of cancers as it relates to the eyelids?
So the most common eyelid cancer is a basal cell carcinoma, by far over 85%. Next would be squamous cell carcinoma. Basal cell carcinomas most commonly are seen on the lower eyelid. It turns out that the brow bone tends to shade the upper eyelid a little bit more, so we tend to see those cancers more on the lower eyelid. But it's very common to see basal cell carcinomas on the eyelids.
And those are the ones that you want to pick up early, like any
Correct.
Skin cancer, because they can be locally invasive.
Exactly.
So how does it begin?
So,
lower eyelid.
You know, we talked about the function of eyelids and, you know, trying to preserve function first and then cosmesis. Basal cell carcinomas, as you know, they don't metastasize, but we do want to pick them up as early as possible because when we remove it, we would like to have as much normal eyelid left behind as possible so it can function like it should. Typically, I will work with a Mohs surgeon to remove the basal cell carcinoma, and then I do the reconstruction.
So the Mohs surgeon is typically a dermatologist
correct.
Who gets special training
correct.
To take layered approaches to try to preserve tissue.
Correct. So we're trying to remove as little of the eyelid as possible while still taking all of the tumor cells off of the eyelid.
And those things untreated, can they grow into your eyeball?
Basal cells don't tend to, but there are different forms. There is a more aggressive form, and particularly basal cell carcinomas or any eyelid cancers that get into the inner corner of the eyelid, there's a lot of structures, blood vessels, the tear drainage system. If it gets into that system, you can have a lot more morbidity and problems with the eye overall. So we really like to try to catch these things early. One of the earliest symptoms people can see they may not see a bump or a nodule, but they may have a little red spot that continually gets crusty or gets a little scab on it. That should be a warning sign. If they lose some eyelashes focally in an area, you know, that could be a sign that, hey, you know, my eyelashes, it's red and my eyelashes aren't growing in this area. That might be something. Or the eyelashes may grow in an abnormal fashion. I just had a patient sent to me a few weeks ago who was sent to me for abnormal growing eyelashes, but I always, you know, part of my job is to figure out, well, why do they have eyelashes growing in the wrong direction? And it was an underlying, we did a biopsy, an underlying basal cell carcinoma. And wow. Unfortunately, what I suggested to this patient, she was wonderful, but she said, oh my goodness, all my friends have had Mohs surgery before, and I've seen that, and they all have these little spots cut out of them. I don't want to be one of those people, but unfortunately, she had to be one of those folks, but she was getting a nice result.
Really, radiation and maybe some of the medications that can sometimes be used for basal cells might be an option, but they're probably not great ones in the eye.
Not great ones in the eye. You want to just get rid of that. And when you do radiation, there's other morbidity and problems to the eye itself, but it can cause distortion of the tissue and can be tough to appreciate a reoccurrence. So if, you know, you left a few cells behind with the radiation, but they're scarring, you may not recognize if that is recurring as soon as you'd like it to.
And what about just your – you mentioned before about this issue of dry eyes, and I know that's a very common condition. When do people – what is the role of the type of surgery that you do for dry eyes? Why would that need to happen, and what kind of outcomes might it actually improve?
So, you know, dry eye is very common. Probably about 15 or 20 years ago, we would just say, oh, here, use some artificial tears and forget about it. But we realize now that dry eye is – very significant, can have a lot of effects on vision and the comfort of the eye. And so there's a lot of things we do for dry eye. But with regards to the eyelids work as a pump. And we produce tears that lubricate our eye. That's opposed to tears that we just cry. The tears we cry are just salt water. It's a reflex tear for irritation that we produce in response to irritation or emotion. The tears that lubricate our eyes have three basic ingredients: oil, water, and mucus, to help lubricate the eye. Well, the eyelids not only cover the eye, so they keep the eye from getting dried out, and every time we blink, it re-moistens the eye. So they're acting as a pump. And if those muscles are weak and we're not properly distributing the tear over the surface of our eye, we need to correct that. That's where the lower eyelid surgery that I mentioned a little bit earlier, it's called ectropion when the lower eyelid is stretchy or rolling away from the eye. And sometimes we have to tighten the tendon, bring that lid back so that we make a more effective or efficient pump with our eyelids so that the tears are distributed more properly.
I'm blinking a little more.
I know,
frequently right now.
I know.
I want that pump to keep on working there.
Right. Yeah, they showed that the Chinese actually showed an interesting study. When we read, use computer, drive, when we're concentrating, our blink rate goes a little less than half. And so if you have dry eye and you're wondering why they feel so gritty when you're doing things like using the computer for extended periods of time, it's just because you're not blinking as often.
We should focus less and work less.
Sounds good to me.
Blink more. You know, Adam and I, having the perspective of family physicians, focus a lot on prevention. And I wonder, as you look at the array of problems that people have with their eyes and eyelids that lead them to you, if you have any recommendations for people about ways to care for their eyes or prevent some of these problems that we've talked about today.
It's difficult. And prevention, it's hard to prevent heavy upper eyelids, extra skin developing. I mean, we do know that good ultraviolet blocking will help, you know, prevent some of the sun damage. So a good sunglasses with ultraviolet A and ultraviolet B, 100% blockage, should help with prevention or, you know, slowing down the growth of skin cancers. Remember that car glass does not stop the penetration of ultraviolet A, and that's present in anytime the sun is out, whether it's bright or not. If there's daylight, there's ultraviolet A rays, and that causes cancer, skin cancer as well. So,
and you know, tanning. What
and tanning. Well, tan. I mean,
that's not UVA.
So A ages and B burns, and we're not getting into the aging so much right now, but and all the cosmetic stuff. But both A and B can cause skin cancer, so you want to make sure that even when there's some daylight, that we have good protection of our eyelids help reduce the skin cancers?
Well, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't at least ask a question about the cosmetic aspect, because I think it is significant, and it's not just about cosmetic. I think, you know, it has to be a good portion of some things that you do. And people understand, you know, when they're looking to what types of cosmetic procedures do you do frequently, and what is the main reason why people are looking for that, and what should they be looking for if they're thinking about where to have that done?
Wow, that's a lot. Okay.
I could be in that situation myself in a year or two.
What things should we be considering?
Well,
right. Thank you, Christy.
So I'm going to put a plug for oculoplastic surgeons. We have a lot of wonderful plastic surgeons, ENT, plastic, oral maxillofacial surgeons at UNC. Why are oculoplastic surgeons the best for eyelid surgery?
Well, that's the question I was going to ask.
We have specialized training in the anatomy around the eye. We deal with complications of previous surgeries. We're specialists in the reconstruction of eyelids and the periocular tissues. Here at UNC, my partner Jonathan Dutton and I, we don't get into facelifts and neck lifts, but there are oculoplastic surgeons in the United States that is part of their scope of practice as well. We focus mainly on our blepharoplasties, upper and lower eyelids, blepharoplasties for redundant skin that's affecting vision in the upper lids, or for puffy eyelids that isn't really affecting vision. So that would be your cosmetic approach or cosmetic portion of that. Forehead surgery. So the eyebrows can be too low as well. And so we do forehead lifts. Uh-huh. There's a lot of different forehead lifting techniques to help raise eyebrows. And I'm still trying to figure out how Joan Rivers has her eyebrows as high as they are, but I'm sure multiple surgeries have helped with that.
We'll have to ask that question.
We'll have to ask that too. But we also do a lot of functional Botox or botulinum toxin injections for people with blepharospasm, but then from a cosmetic standpoint, we're very good at the anatomy around the eyes.
Does it work for blepharospasm?
Oh, it's great. It's
because that's a common where you have the spasm of the eyelid, which can be very bothersome.
Oh, it can be blinding.
Not cosmetic.
Some patients can't open their eyelids. There is actually a benign essential blepharospasm foundation. It's a very difficult disease, and those patients we see usually every 2 to 3 months for regular Botox. And that's an interesting story. Probably 99.9% of my functional blepharospasm patients think Botox is the worst thing in the world. It's horrible. It's painful. And probably 99.9% of my cosmetic patients say, oh, it's not that bad. it's the perspective of the candy versus the medicine. You know, I want it versus I have to have it.
You know, we'll get our health science librarians to put up a couple of those terms on our blog, blepharoplasty, blepharospasm. It's hard for me to even say them, but just to make sure our listeners, if you'd like to go and understand a little bit more about what those procedures are and what those conditions are, that would be helpful. Thank you so much, Dr. Fowler.
Thank you very much.
For taking time to teach us and to teach our listeners about eyelid surgeries.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Christy, we're going to talk about really interesting health questions and concerns.
And if you have a question you want us to address on an upcoming show, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu.
And we're going to talk about aortic stenosis that's been picked up on an echocardiogram.
And we're going to talk about warts.
Warts on the fingers and warts everywhere else.
And also about porphyria.
That interesting disease and unfortunate for some people. And then finally, we'll talk about someone who's been diagnosed with pinworms but is still having vomiting.
Interesting.
Yeah,
let's take our first one.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have high blood pressure, and I was told by my doctor that a recent echocardiogram test said that I had aortic stenosis. He said not to worry, that it was not serious, but it sounds serious to me.
Well, I could see how that would be something that you might worry about, even though your doctor said not to worry. I could see that.
And the good news is that most people, as you age, get some of this aortic stenosis, where there's just a little bit of a stiffer part of your heart where the blood flows through there. Most people, this is pretty mild, but it can range and become severe.
Right. If you were to people get echocardiograms for a lot of reasons. Maybe they want to see the size of the heart and whether or not it's any thicker or not. But if you actually get a copy of that report and you read everything on there, you'll be pretty scared, I think, because there's lots of things that are oftentimes on there, including that you might have a little bit of a leaky valve. And we say, look, listen to our terms, Christy, a little bit of a leaky valve.
Well, I mean, that's scary, but it's not. All kinds of real mild changes of the heart that they notice that, you know, can be significant if they develop and become a bigger deal over time. But what you do to prevent that is, you know, exercise and have a good weight and not
get your blood pressure down.
Get your blood pressure down and all of those things that to have a heart healthy life. But for most people, having some aortic stenosis on an echocardiogram is not a big deal.
It's only if you ask your doctor, when would it be significant? And how often maybe do I need to follow that, which may not be very often. Good luck with you. Thank you for your question.
Let's take our very next house call question about warts.
I have had warts on my fingers for years. On a recent pap smear test, I was told I was exposed to warts as well. Could these be the same warts, or was I exposed from my partner?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because you can get warts almost anywhere. But there are different strains of that HPV or human papillomavirus that typically come up on different parts of the body.
And people can get warts on their fingers, which are kind of common warts, call them finger warts other ways. And then there's warts on your feet, and call those sometimes feet warts or other ways, again, medical terms. And those are kind of ones that we are associated with strains of this HPV, which are not really cancerous. We don't really worry so much, but we do want to treat them so that they don't spread.
And you can also get genital warts that come up, you know, in the area of your genitals. And then you can get a different strain of HPV that can put you at higher risk for developing cervical cancer. But typically, there are different strains that cause the different types of warts.
And so, could these be the same warts that you exposed from your partner? Well, probably not. I mean, anything's possible in medicine. We never say never, but this is probably unlikely. I don't think we can attribute it to that.
I mean, if it's reassuring, I mean, it's important to follow your pap smears and follow your doctor's recommendations, but HPV is very, very common. I mean, up to 10% of children have some sort of wart on their foot or their hand at some point. And for most people, the warts go away. And that's true for a lot of the HPV strains, that they sometimes will clear up on their own, or sometimes you need to have them frozen or treated in a way to help them go away. But sounds like you're on top of it and paying attention and asking the right questions.
Let's listen to our very next house call, Christy.
I was diagnosed recently with porphyria after having a seizure and being confused. I have to have now what is called phlebotomy now periodically. Can you tell me a little more about this and where I may find support for this condition?
Porphyria, that's a very complicated condition. Let's spell it first for our listeners, because they may not have ever heard of this particular condition. And it's called porphyria, P-O-R-P-H-Y-R-I-A. I bet if you had to spell this on the spelling bee for the National Spelling Bee Championship, many of us would fail.
Random fact, I went home to my husband's parents' house this weekend and found this little write-up about how my husband won the school spelling bee.
I want you to go home and ask him if he can spell porphyria.
Exactly.
Oh, wait, he's an ER doctor. Of course he'll get it.
Let's
talk about this, because porphyria is a rare disease, and it's a genetic disease, so it's sometimes passed down in families.
Yeah, this happens where part of the hemoglobin that's in your blood, the heme, is not made properly.
And because it's not made properly, certain things that would normally be broken down, certain enzymes build up in the body, and that's toxic to the body. And the most common type of porphyria is what's called porphyria cutanea tarda, or porphyria of the skin. But there are multiple other types of porphyria that can attack not just the skin, where people get real rashes, but it could also cause problems with abdominal pain or the central nervous system, like you had with seizures.
And most people, and depending on what type of porphyria you have, there are different types. Most doctors would recommend that you avoid alcohol or drugs that trigger an attack for you, avoid injuring your skin. Certain sunlight can set it off, and that you eat a high carbohydrate diet. So those are specific things that you would need to talk with your doctor about, depending on what type of porphyria you have.
And then occasionally, phlebotomy or removal of blood from the body is one of the treatments because it lowers the concentration of those enzymes that build up into the blood. And so it can be controlled. So, you know, if you have something unusual sometimes, getting testing for all types of possibilities and thinking about things to find out a reason, because in this particular case, it can be treated.
Yep. Let's take our very next house call question.
My daughter has been having lots of vomiting over the last year, ever since she was diagnosed with pinworms. They were treated successfully. She is also being treated for anxiety with Prozac. Do you think the pinworms are back?
Pinworms. It just sort of makes me squirm a little bit to hear about it. I'm so sorry that you had to go through that.
I hope you don't have them, Christy.
No, I don't. I never have had them, but it's always something, you know, I've had to treat it a number of times, and I'm thankful that my children haven't had it.
That's right. It's kind of like, you know, different things that we know how miserable it can make people feel, like, you know, scabies or other things where there's lots of itching. But the question here, and congratulations, they were treated successfully, and they are easy to be treated. I mean, that's
good
news.
Good medicines, mebendazole, different by-mouth medicines that you can give, even come in easy forms to give to children. So there are good treatments for it.
And the question is the vomiting related to the treatment or recurrence of the pinworms? And that's tough. You probably do need to talk with your primary care provider, maybe the specialist, but my short answer is probably not. I don't know what you think, Christy.
Well, I think, you know, if someone vomits right after taking the medication, then I would be worried that it really got in and made a difference. And reinfection is common, even if you have effective therapy. But usually, you know, the symptoms are more in the itching and
the bottom part of our bodies, not the top
part. Not the vomiting.
And certainly Prozac has side effects, and certainly having a child who's anxious and some other things going on makes you certainly worried here. Regardless, this needs to be looked into.
Absolutely. I'd definitely go in and kind of start over with the doctor and just ask all these questions and try to put the pieces together.
Well, thank you for all of your questions today and helping us put some pieces together about your health. We appreciate all of your issues and concerns that are important to you and sharing those with us. You can send us your own questions at yourhealth@unc.edu, and you can visit us at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on all kinds of social media, and even search for our new health app by searching Your Health, one word, for a free download.
We want to thank the staff of WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Amy Fowler. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We will look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.